History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and invest a little bit of time. Maybe you'll be motivated to do that with someone in your life. But our aim here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Robbie Robinson spent most of his life in California, but he lives now in Henderson, Nevada. We're going to hear some of his experiences with the 11th Armored Division in the Battle of the Bulge and beyond. But let's start out with his early years in Compton, California.
Compton, California in 1925, when I was born, was a very, very quiet, middle-class little town. My dad was working for Firestone Tire and Rubber as an electrician, learning the trade, really. He wasn't an electrician yet. You could walk all over town. Nobody would bother you. I lived there until I was 12. And one of the things we used to do is get on the Pacific Electric car for a nickel and go into downtown Los Angeles to the little street there, what the heck's the name of it, at any rate, and get taquitos with green sauce, and that was a dime. And then one of the other things that we did from Compton was get on the Pacific Electric and go to the beach and take what we called a skimmer board. And these were, I find out, I was one of the original kids that did skimming on the thing. And we'd make our own plywood board and then throw it down on about 2 inches of water and jump on it and scale into the waves. And that was way before even surfing was a big deal as far as Hawaii went, but it wasn't in the United States yet. But we were skimming clear back then. Then when I lived in San Diego, well, then that whole area down there, Ocean Beach clear down to the Navy base, was an excellent place to do that. And I had a house on the beach there that was $90 a month, and you're 50 feet from the sand. You could hear the ocean every night, you know, crashing. Beautiful situation.
As you're that kid, you know, and taking the Pacific Electric here and there, were there some ideas you had at a young age, some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do?
No, actually, my dad was, it wasn't until I got back out of the military that I realized that he was electrical contracting, and he needed, desperate to need help, working out of the back of his car. I went down and bought a brand new pickup, paid cash for it. When I came home, I had $12,000 in the bank. And I got that by trading with the Russians on the border of Czechoslovakia when we ended up at Linz in Austria, in that area. And we were there long enough to trade with the Russians. They had been paid in 5 years. And their theory was that you had your room and board and food and whatever, so you didn't need any cash. So then they paid them, and they had pockets full of cash, and they didn't know what to do with it. Most of them were uneducated. In fact, as I remember, one place in Linz, Austria, a Russian was going down the street carrying a toilet. Had no idea that it needed plumbing. And none of them knew how to drive, but they were fascinated with the cars, and they would try to get somebody to get out of the car and commandeer the car, but they didn't know how to operate it. So it was pretty sad. But one of the things that they did have, because they had so much money, that they would buy a pair of GI shoes that we were trying to get rid of for free. They were brand new, $50 American. And then a watch like I had, you could buy at the PX for $7, were $300 American. So it was very easy to make a whole bunch of money real fast. And then the first thing you did is wire it home. And my dad would put it in the bank for me. So when I came home, why, he thought I was absolutely wealthy. And I had about $12,000 bucks in the bank.
Back then, that's quite wealthy. And I know you told me that when you were 12, your family moved up to Kern County to Taft, and you started high school there and then continued high school back on the other side of the grapevine. I'm curious, though, what you remember about December 7th, 1941, because it seems like everybody remembers something. Do you remember where you were and how you found out?
Yeah, I remember listening to Roosevelt on the radio when they attacked Pearl Harbor, and I was 16, and I realized then, guess what? I don't know where you're going to be, but you're going to be in the military. One way or another, that's a given thing. We were in actually Taft, California. The interesting thing about that was that when I was 12 up there, my dad said, well, you're a big boy now. We'll give you a rifle. So he gave me a .22, 500 rounds of ammunition. I'd learn to take the gun apart, put it back together, know all about it. Then he would say, okay, now you take 5 shells and go out and come back. We would go out hunting almost every day. I had a little buddy that also went with me. He had a gun. And so I actually grew up from that time when I was young, probably 12, 13, 14, hunting and hiking. We lived 12 miles from Buena Vista Lake. And we would hike and not even think about it, hunting, plinking away at stuff. I didn't like to kill game, but I liked to shoot at it. So you got pretty good at missing them real close. And we'd hike to the lake, wade around in the lake a little bit, then hike over to the main highway from Bakersfield to Taft, stand there with your gun in your hand, and they'd pick you up and take you back into town. So this was, you know, a standard thing that the kids all had. But it paid off very well because when I got in the service, I not only was aware of the gun, but I could shoot. And an awful lot of guys from other areas had never handled a rifle. So this put me about 2 steps above everybody else. I could hit the target. Then I did that also with a tank gun. They would strap a .45 to the barrel of the tank gun, align it so that you could use the firing mechanism in the tank to aim at little matchbooks and things like this in the ground, like 50 feet out in front of the tank. And you learn how to manipulate the gun, and then you'd fire that .45. And that was a fun thing to do for me. Most guys wanted to go in town and get drunk. I didn't drink, and alcohol didn't agree with me, so I didn't drink. So I'd go out and do this tank thing. And as a result, I became an expert at tank gunnery. And as a result, I got into serious trouble.
Well, and we're going to hear about that, and you'd end up in the 11th Armored Division, but that's not what you were initially thinking when you were going into the service. Tell me the story of how you ended up in the military, what you thought was going to happen versus what actually unfolded.
We had an opportunity to go to any service you wanted. The Marine guy had a leg missing. I didn't really appreciate that. The Navy, I said, no, I want any part of the water. If your ship sinks, you're in the water. So I think the best thing to do is stay on dry land. So I went over to the Army, and the old sergeant there said, well, what you do is you go to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and you go to Officer's Candidate School. When you graduate, then you can transfer into the Air Corps. Well, I didn't know it at the time that was practically a lie. So I went into Fort Knox, Kentucky to go into training for that type of thing. They unloaded us from the train and had us hike at double time to the camp, and then assigned us to barracks. The first thing we had to do was go through and get our uniforms and then get into uniform, and as soon as we did that, you got out into lined up again, and they started, every place you went, you ran. So that was the essential thing. And as you progress with your training, they would sort out the people that seemed to excel in whatever it was. And one of the things they had was the obstacle course, and being a little kid like I was, why I could run that dang obstacle course faster than most people. I was small but fast, and so I won that, And that put me in the forefront with the company commander. I didn't know at the time, but he was gambling on it. And so then they had a contest among the battalions, racing all these guys over the obstacle course, and I won that. So then that meant a three-day pass and several other things. So there was a lot of good things that happened there. But all the time when I was going through basic training, one of the things they'd have you do is learn how to drive the tank, and it was difficult. If you were from a farm community, you were used to tractors and things like this, and you probably could operate it. But being from another type of community, I didn't know anything about tractors or anything like that. But I could shoot. We would take the tank and fire at moving targets. And they had a little moving target on a rail with a white sheet. And they gave you three rounds, and you were supposed to bracket that. Bracketing means you fired one high, one low, and then supposed to hit the target. So they had me three rounds and had me shoot at the target. And the first thing I did was when it went up to the top of the rail, went from down below up a hill and around. I hit the sheet right off the bat. That was the first shot. The second shot, I hit the rail, little cart coming down from the rise, and it blew it off the track, and the lieutenant yelled at me, "You're going to have to pay for that." But the CO was betting on it, so I somehow didn't have to pay for it.
Sounds like you were a natural.
Another thing that we did is they had us drive the tank to the river, and you were supposed to get your right tread wet, just edge into the river, and then circle around back up and go through a firing thing with the machine guns. And I didn't get my tread quite wet. So the lieutenant was a brand new lieutenant in his brand new uniform, and he said, "No, you go back down and get the thing, turn around and go down again." I wanted to go back on the same track. He said, "No," directed me to another direction, just a little bit further down the river. So I was supposed to get my tread wet. What I didn't know, and he didn't know, is that the river at that point cut into the bank instead of shoring away from the bank. So we went to get the tread wet, and the whole tank slowly, very, very slowly, just tilted right into the river. And it got the assistant driver wet, tossed the lieutenant into the river in his brand new uniform. And, of course, he was very mad at that. So then he said, "You know, all right, you guys set up a perimeter around that tank and stay here all night." So we had exactly doing that. You know, what we didn't know was that they had GIs that were the enemy, and they would come and capture you. And when they captured you, then you spent 2 days in the pokey with bread and water. So we were not about to get captured. So they came to capture us, yelling us to surrender, and they were across the river. So we yelled back, "You know, you have to come and get us." So they started out across the river. What they didn't realize is we had two 30 caliber machine guns and a 50 with live ammunition. So we just fired a round above their head, and they decided that maybe it wasn't a good idea to capture these guys. And we did not get captured.
That's one of the best maneuver stories I've heard, I think.
And I find out that the attrition for second lieutenants in tanks was about 80% North Africa. So I decided that's not a good idea. So then they said, "Well, you have a pretty good memory. Maybe you ought to go into reconnaissance." At that time, they didn't have any way to fly over and observe. You had to go out and memorize the terrain and then come back and tell them what's what. And essentially, that's what we ended up doing.
Which is a really dangerous job, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, the guys, I had 22 guys in our platoon, and 18 of them got killed or wounded. So, you know, I got out with hardly any problems at all. I was afraid to re-enlist, though, because he tried to kill me.
Was it the intelligence and reconnaissance platoon?
Well, G2 is sort of like intelligence. They had us go out and pick up information. They would leave information. You know, they couldn't broadcast it. You can't mail it. So they would, the Office of Strategic Services, OSS people, would leave information at a particular point, and they'd have us go out and sometimes pick that up. Sometimes you'd go out early in the morning, sometimes at night. The object was to get out there and retain that and get back without being seen or caught or shot at. You had to be pretty elusive to do that.
Well, and I want to hear some of those stories, examples that check some of those boxes. But first of all, tell me what it was like when you were heading overseas. Because you're still a pretty young man, and I'm guessing you've never done anything like this before. Did you think that you would make it back, that you'd come back and see your family again?
We went on the HMS Cimmeria, which was a British ship. They sailed around the North Atlantic, putting a convoy together for almost a month before we started for Europe. They were feeding us kind of a watery oatmeal and stewed apricots, three meals a day. And we find out later that they had all kinds of American food stored in the lockers there, but they were taking it home to the folks in England. And we didn't get any of that food. So that kind of turned me against the English, and I happened to be one of them.
Did it turn you against apricots, too?
No, actually not really. They were greedy, like everybody else, and taking advantage of anything they possibly could. You learn by experience. One of the things, I had a Mohawk haircut and a good suntan, and I had a pretty good sized knife that I carried with me. They thought I was a Native American. Had no idea that I was an Englishman like they were.
Yeah, you were telling me earlier, your father was from England?
Yeah, my dad immigrated from England in 1906, or I don't remember. Anyway, he came over with a bunch of other Robinsons. They're all related. They all came as a group, scattered out. And I have relatives that I've never seen, but I don't even know where they are.
Well, I know it's a long time ago, 1944, when you're heading across the Atlantic. But do you remember what you expected, what you thought was going to happen, or what it felt like to be doing that?
Well, the thing is that I enjoyed sailing. In fact, there's a lot of times I'd go up near the bow of the ship and just watch the thing crash into the waves and come back up. It was an enjoyable crossing, although it was somewhat stormy, but I enjoyed it I guess I would have made a pretty good sailor. But coming home, I was on the USS George Washington, which was the largest ship that the Americans had at the time. And we had 4,500 WACs and nurses all on board, plus the GIs coming back from there. And I got seasick for 2 days. And then they organized a theater group or a show. So I emceed that and did some voices and told some jokes and stuff like that. But I'd been doing that. In fact, after the war was over, I helped organize a band. I don't play a musical instrument, but I could seem to put guys together, and we organized a band, and I went along as the MC and stuff like that. It was fun.
And you mentioned voices. We haven't talked about this yet, but even after the war, you did radio drama where you would do voiceover voices and impressions and stuff. Where did that come from? Is that something you did as a kid?
Yeah, in fact, when I was in about the third or fourth grade, something like that, I found out I could do Donald Duck. The kids would ask me to do that. Then I realized that I could mimic some of the other radio voices. So we put together a little script, a little program, and entertain people at various activities. And we're invited to do that. And that was kind of the forerunner to getting involved in some of the theater that I did later.
And I know you're 97 now, but can you still do any of those voices?
I can. There was a program called The Life of Riley. One of the characters on there was Digby O'Dell. Digby O'Dell was the friendly undertaker. And usually when he was coming on the program, of course you have to imagine this because it's not like television, he would be maybe walking down the street or something, he'd come across to Riley, and he'd say, "Good evening, Riley. 'Tis me, Digby O'Dell. You're looking fine today. Very natural. You know, I was in the golf course, and they wouldn't let me play. I kept digging up the green."
That's pretty good. I used to listen to that program on the Golden Age of Radio Theater, Digby O'Dell, the Friendly Undertaker. I'm glad you still got it. And if any other voices come to mind later, feel free to share that inspiration. And that was some gallows humor with Digby O'Dell, but you were going into a situation where it was life and death. When did you realize that? Was there a moment where it hit you that this is really extreme and this could cost you your life?
Well, you know, the first thing off the bat, we were in the Battle of the Bulge. There was no room. You didn't get room service. I just don't understand it. And there wasn't any place to sleep except in the snow. So you had to learn how to curl up and stay warm, try to dig through the snow to the ground and maybe dig a foxhole or something like this. And that was first several days, before we did that kind of thing. Unfortunately, we were not clothed or shooed for that time of weather.
And we can all imagine what that means, but we want Robbie Robinson to spell it out for us. So we'll do that when we come back. Close calls, concentration camps, and more recently, an honor flight to our nation's capital. We'll try to cover it all when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Robbie Robinson of Henderson, Nevada. Originally from Compton, California, he served as a reconnaissance scout with the 11th Armored Division during World War II, experiencing his first taste of combat during the Battle of the Bulge. We heard him say that he did not have the proper clothes or shoes for the extreme weather conditions they would face in Belgium and Luxembourg.
My toes got not frozen, but almost like frostbite. Probably that's what happened. And for about 6 weeks, I walked on my heels because it took too much effort and pain to put my feet down on the ground.
And let's remind everybody listening that you're a California kid. Right. You've never been in weather like this before, right?
No. Well, I got to go to Idlewild to the snow a few times, but Bastogne was an entirely different thing. First place, you're under fire. The second thing is that you didn't have the proper clothing, and you didn't really know what was going on other than the fact that you're getting bombarded, artillery shells breaking into the Ardennes Forest. And we knew we were in a combat, but we didn't even know it was Bastogne until probably a week later. And then by then we were in Luxembourg, so we'd moved on, you know. Finally, they got to the point where they were giving us information and assign us an objective, and we knew what we were supposed to do and what we were supposed to look for. But one time there, it was just maybe a week or so after we were in that battle, we were up in the kitchen truck. The kitchen truck had three stoves in it. That's where we cooked for the troops. Some of the guys found out that I knew how to make donuts, so they talked us into going up there, and me and a couple other guys would make donuts. And so we were up there. Well, my buddy took off for, I've forgotten what, maybe to go to the restroom. Anyway, I was by myself up there in the truck, and I heard this kind of tapping on the tailgate. So I came out. Well, there are two screens between you and the dark. So you open the first canvas and then stand in between that one and the second one and make sure it's down so no light would show. And then you open the second one. Now you see two silhouettes standing out there at the tailgate. So I saw, well, okay, there's a couple of guys. So I said, come on up. So they climbed up into the truck. Well, German and English is so close that come and see here or come here is the same practically. In fact, it's a Germanic language, essentially is English. So they get into the daylight, into the night there, into the light for the thing where we were in the kitchen. And here's two young, I'd say probably maybe 16, 17, German soldiers. And they were scared, hungry, and cold. So we give them a cup of coffee, a couple of donuts, and they put their hands up and said, comrade, which is actually the signal that they wanted to surrender. So we said, yeah, all right. So then they drank their coffee, and then we said, okay, you know, follow me, come here. And they went over to the tent where the commanding officer was, went in there, got permission to go into the CO, talk to him, walked in there with these two guys and said they wanted to surrender. And the captain looked at me like he was absolutely astounded, and then he had the corporal of the guard take the two guys away, and he pointed at me and he said, you, I want to see. And he said, now, it's fine that they wanted to surrender, but the next time that you take a German soldier prisoner, take his gun away.
You forgot an important detail, huh?
Yeah, didn't even occur to me. And they were little teenagers. They were much younger than I was, you know. And I actually felt sorry for them. They were probably the end of the German army. They'd just been grabbed off the street and thrown into a uniform and had no idea what was going on. I doubt if they had any basic training at all. Anyway, that was it.
Well, and a moment ago, you know, you were talking about how cold it was at the Bulge, the effect it had on your toes, and so many guys who were there have shared that with me. My grandfather was a doctor at the Bulge, and he said that's what he treated most was frozen feet. And you lived it, so maybe it's not as big a deal in your mind now as it was then, but I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're sleeping in the snow. Yeah. You're freezing to death. You can't even walk on your toes, and you don't know how much longer you're going to do this. So what was it that kept you persevering and enduring those kind of extreme conditions?
We had a pretty good pride, a good group of soldiers. There were a few skirmishes and things like this, but there was you were part of a great organization, and you know, you performed, and you realize that, you know, this is not a game. So you did what you were trained to do. And fortunately, when they put you through that basic training and tank and stuff like that, and all the maneuvers, various things that we did, you built a sense of pride. So you were glad that you could do that, you know. It was something that I think is like they call it, pride or morale. You tried very hard to do as good as you possibly could, because it wasn't to get recognition. You actually realized you were in a war and people were shooting at you, and you had to shoot back.
Which tells me you definitely had some close calls and might even still be carrying some shrapnel, and we can talk about that. One of the things that you've held on to is your original map for G2 that showed everywhere that you guys went. And a moment ago, you said that, you know, initially when you first got there, which is right at the start of the Bulge, that you guys didn't really know what you were doing, but then they told you some of what you were looking for. So can you give us maybe an example of how that would work, what they tell you, how many guys you go out with, and what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, essentially, reconnaissance consisted of going out, and they'd give you a general idea of what the terrain looked like. They had a pretty good idea of what the country looked like. They wanted you to go out and survey the area, memorize as much as you possibly could of what's going on, and then come back and then point to it on a map what was going on. There's a group of soldiers, or there's a camp or whatever. You didn't have any kind of aerial surveillance. You know, you had to actually point out, well, maybe 15 miles or 10 miles away, there was a large group of tanks or people that you knew where in general they were. And that was it. I mean, you go out and find what's going on and come back and tell them. It's just like hide and seek. That's what it is. You go out and find them and come back and tell about it. And now it's entirely different.
Well, you hope you come back and tell them about it, because you told us earlier, if people were listening closely, that of the 22 guys in your platoon, 18 of them were killed or wounded. What were some of the things you had to watch out for, be prepared for, or be on the lookout for?
You could run into an encampment and not even know it until you know. I had an incident one time. We went out to survey a particular area, and we realized it was getting light too soon, so we wouldn't be able to get back. The best thing we could do was just to hunker down in a little alcove that we found and some bushes and stuff like that, and stay there and hope that nobody found you. And as it broke daylight, we looked up and we were looking right down the barrel of a gun. It made us a little bit excited, because you could see that, and yet you didn't know until it finally got light and that area was abandoned, and it was an abandoned tank, and you're staring down the barrel of that. It's like it scared you to death. I'd hate to do your laundry. Anyway, we, you know, got back and laughed about that later. But if you can't get back, the only thing you can do is stay where you are until you could make contact. Sometimes they catch up with you. Sometimes you could get back. I had another incident one time on the Rhine River. We were actually in the snowbank above the road, about maybe 6 feet above the road in a snowbank, observing the road and the Rhine River, which was maybe another 50 yards away. Along came a long column of German soldiers smoking and talking and walking. And here we are with binoculars and supposed to be observing the whole area, and they walk within probably 20 feet of us. We're in the snowbank, don't even breathe, don't make any kind of sound at all, and they finally walked on. You're that close, and yet you don't dare make any kind of a move at all. So after it was over, well, then you wipe the sweat off your brow and go back and say, well, we hope we won't have to do that again.
I can just imagine the heart pounding in your chest in a moment like that.
Another situation where we were running down the Rhine River with the 11th Armored Division, the tank column was going along. You have lights on, but they're just a little lights, like the tiniest light you can imagine to keep track of each other. And one of the things that the Americans did was shine lights on the clouds from aircraft carriers, from the aircraft search things, and it would light the clouds enough that you could see to move. And so we're on this, in this column, and here came out of a side road a column going the opposite direction. They're heading back from where we came, and suddenly I realized that it was about probably 25 vehicles. They were all German soldiers, and all hell broke loose. I'll tell you, that was a mess. We finally, they gave up and captured them. That was where I learned my first German words. It was Rauchen Sie nicht, don't smoke, because we were putting them on top of the 5-gallon tanks in the GI trucks that were full of gas. And they'd get up there on top of that thing, going to light a cigarette. No, you're not going to do that.
And that's a couple times now that you've alluded to your awareness or knowledge of languages. And that's something that, from my understanding, actually distinguished you a little bit over there and gave you some other duties that you might not have had otherwise. Do I have that right?
Well, yeah, the language was fairly easy to pick up. One of the things that they realized that I could communicate pretty easily with whatever group that was around. So they had me take people that were conscripted from various countries back to their home. So they taught me to how to say, I don't speak your language, in that language, and you could communicate pretty well with them. They had a fair good idea that they were going home, but it was a good idea to have an American soldier escort them. So they understood, most of them understood the German home again means going home. You could talk to them a little bit in their Italian or French or Polish or something. So they taught us how to say, I don't speak your language, in that language, like je ne comprends pas, no kabish italian, prekinti nikt, or ne razumi polski. So there were four different languages there that you could just tell them, hey, I can't talk to you. But the funny thing is that a lot of the European people had a fair knowledge of English anyway. America is the promised land. Everybody wants to come here. And one of the things they realize is they need the language.
Your daughter Sylvia ratted you out on this one. I don't know if you go around telling everybody this, but she said that you took a little shrapnel from a mortar round once upon a time. What happened there?
Well, I was souvenir hunting. We were out there looking around. I thought, maybe I can find a German gun or something. And I'm out because it was a field of several deceased German soldiers. So we're out there in the snow wading around trying to find something like that, and somebody dropped some mortar in, and unfortunately I was trying to run a little bit. You have an overcoat and 6 layers of clothing on, so you can't move very fast. But somehow I picked up a little, just superficial with all the clothes on, it was amazing that I even got hit at all. I picked up a little bit of shrapnel in one of my wrists and in the right shin. You could have done that with climbing through a barbed wire fence. It wasn't anything enough. Just wipe the blood off, put a bandage on it, and keep going. Actually, you qualified for a Purple Heart, but it was just one more thing to carry, one more thing to keep track of. And I didn't realize at the time that it was going to be worth something later on. But I'm glad I didn't get it anyway. I didn't really deserve it. You're out there looking for freebies and digging around. You're not even fighting, for crying out loud. You're trying to find something. So, no.
Candid memories, vivid descriptions. It's pretty amazing to hear from 97-year-old Robbie Robinson today, isn't it? If you'd like to explore some photos of Mr. Robinson and a short video with him, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. When we come back, we'll hear what it was like to witness the horrors of a Nazi concentration camp. And on the other end of the emotional spectrum, what he got out of his recent trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friend in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website? That's simple. CVTR.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments. One of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating conversation today with 97-year-old Robbie Robinson of Henderson, Nevada. He served with the 11th Armored Division during World War II, went on to a long career as an electrician in Southern California while moonlighting with a little radio theater and other performance arts. He even served on a mounted unit for his county. His life has been quite full, but in order to enjoy all of that, he first had to make it home from World War II. I don't want to gloss over anything that's important. Were there other situations that you look back on now and you say that was a really close call where it that could have been my time?
Yeah, one time I was underneath the truck and they were strafing from a hill up above us, and you could see the bullets hitting the ground, and it was like maybe 4 or 5 feet ahead of you, but you could see them hitting in the ground, and we were hiding underneath the truck. We got shot at quite a number of times at various incidents. I know when Harold Maddox got shot out of my Jeep, well, I actually didn't get shot. He got shot in the Jeep, and he slumped over and reached up and pulled him down into the ditch, and the ditch was half full of water. So I had to lay there in that ice water until we finally got control of the battle. But we were taking fire from behind us, because that's where they were. We were in advance. We weren't sure if they were shooting at us or shooting at them. But nevertheless, why you were under fire in that whole situation. But yeah, this is a lot of times you have some pretty close calls.
Is there something when you think back on it? It's been a long time, but I know you went on the honor flight recently with Honor Flight Southern Nevada, and that probably stirred a lot of these memories for you. Is there something that you look back on and you say, you know, that was the hardest part, or the most difficult or challenging element of what you did in the war?
One of the things that affected us, and still does today, was when we took Dachau and Breslau concentration camps, and the people were starving. They were emaciated, and we saw that, and the first thing they said is, you cannot feed these people. If you give them food, it'll kill them. So we will take care of them. These were German or French or Italian or whatever, people from other countries that were, for whatever reason, put into there to, it was a work camp, and they had striped uniforms on or clothes. They were emaciated, terrible. We could give them cigarettes, but we couldn't give them any kind of food at all. That stays with you. You see that. The smell was horrendous. It stays with you, unfortunately.
And I mean, I wasn't there. My grandfather was. He liberated Buchenwald, and he had some memories that certainly followed him the rest of his life. Could you ever have imagined that you would see something like that, that human beings had been treated in that kind of fashion?
We had no idea that the Germans were conscripting and putting people into work camps like that. Thank God I didn't see Auschwitz, but Dachau and Breslau was bad enough. That was terrible. But there were some good times, too. There were some good memories. One of them was one time we were on a reconnaissance mission. We came over a hill and looked down, and there was 10,000 Hungarian troops with horse-drawn cannons. The guy that was in charge of the troops said, you know, surrender. They were supposed to be fighting with the Germans, and the Hungarians didn't want any part of that. And this was a whole damn division. So I called back and said, we captured some people, and I said, okay, we'll send them on back. This commander, whatever his name is, reached in his side thing there and pulled out a Hungarian police special 38 pistol and handed it to me. I still have it today. So we got back to the camp to report in, and they were still coming in. They were still coming in, you know, and they didn't know what to do with them. They had, I mean, a whole division, that's 10,000 people. And so they finally figured out, you know. But the wonderful part about that is that some of those Hungarians can really cook. And so we had later on, when the battalions got pretty well established and into peacetime, we had some delicious meals.
And, you know, I was reminded of something else when you talked about souvenir hunting, and it almost cost you your life. There was a pretty good find that you came across at one point, because you've got a photo in here of you with a 35 Ford that you became the owner of for a while.
Well, I bought that from the Burgermeister. The guy that owned that was a USC student, German, going to USC, and then when the war broke out, he shipped the car home and became a Luftwaffe pilot. Unfortunately, he lost his life. And I say that because, I mean, he could have been an American, you know, but he brought that Ford home. The Burgermeister did not even know how to drive. So I went and talked to him about, can we buy that car? I talked to him in German about buying that, and he wanted two cartons of cigarettes. To him, that was like $1,200. To me, it was a dollar. And so I gave him two cartons of cigarettes. I ended up driving that Ford back to the camp and became very popular.
I bet. And you were so popular, you ended up staying over there for a long time after VE Day. But let me ask you about VE Day. Was that a significant day for you when you heard the news that, hey, Germany, after all of this, has surrendered to the Allies?
Well, yeah, I was in Linz, Austria, on the Danube River. And by the way, it's not blue, it's brown. And the upshot I had is they said, well, the war's over, don't shoot anymore. Don't fire anything. Unfortunately, we ran into a couple of Hitlerjugend that didn't want to give up. And so they had to be captured or killed. Other than that, why, we were on the border, we met with the Russians. So the Russians could speak a little German and we could speak a little German, so we communicated back and forth with them. But that was the end of the war, May the 6th for us, on the Danube River in Austria.
And I mentioned you stayed over there a long time. You didn't know when you turned down that Purple Heart that that might have gotten you home sooner. But as it turned out, you got to stand guard during the Nuremberg trials? What did you see there?
See, what they did is they broke up the 11th Armored, and then they put us in the 4th Armored for a while, and I was with the 8th Armored for a short time. I was even with the 16th Armored for a little while. Well, they were shuffling guys around, and during one of those periods, I don't remember which one, they assigned us to walk the perimeter near the Nuremberg trials. And so you're on guard duty, and you just had your rifle, and you covered a particular area. It was guard duty, just like anything else. But everybody did it. I mean, it didn't make any difference if you were a cook or what. I mean, everybody had a chance to walk the guard duty. We didn't know it was a big deal then. Nuremberg trials, which later became a big deal.
Well, and you've shared all these stories, and again, I don't want to leave anything out, so if there's something else that you think is relevant or important, please share. But all this has happened, and we didn't tell everybody that you never finished high school before you went into the Army, and you decided to do that when you came home?
Well, the thing is that, yeah, as soon as my folks moved to the place where they were building a house in Monrovia, I realized it was a good idea. I had gone back to church, and so I established a group of people that were youngsters about the same age I am. I realized it'd probably be a good idea to go back to Monrovia High School, and so I went back and registered to finish the 11th grade. So I finished part of the 11th grade and the 12th grade and graduated from Monrovia in 1947. And during that time, I met two good friends that were both, at that time, had been Navy personnel. And we became very close friends. And so we had a lot in common because we were ex-servicemen and everything. It was a nice trip, a lot of fun. And one of the things that kind of solidified this is I read for a play called Spring Green and ended up with the lead in that play. And that was kind of gave me school recognition. A lot of people knew who you were because you were in that play and they came and saw it when it was presented in the auditorium.
Have you ever been back to some of those areas where you were sleeping in foxholes or getting shot at?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, we're taking people back. I got back to Paris, and I got all over Czechoslovakia and different parts of Germany and Austria. I didn't get to Italy, but I got up on the border of Italy and in Spain. One thing I did get to do, because I had quite a bit of cash, I got to go on a 30-day liberty or pass or whatever you want to call it, to England, and I visited my Aunt Ida, my grandfather's sister, in Kingsland, England. I shipped them a bunch of food from the commissary of the PX. They hadn't had butter and sugar and a lot of things like this, and we could go in and buy what we don't. So I went in and spent a few bucks on a lot of food and had it shipped to them. So they were very grateful about that. And then I visited them for maybe 2 or 3 days, I don't know. Saw the homestead where my grandfather and the family came from, King's Lynn.
And I know the people of Great Britain certainly appreciated the American contributions to World War II because they likely would have lost their freedom otherwise. And I'm thinking you probably have some perspective on that from all the places you were, all the displaced people you helped return to their homeland. What is your perspective on what all of you guys did over there and why it still matters today?
Those people were captured or dominated by the Germans, and we went in and freed them. So it was about freedom, very much like when we broke away from England. You know, it was about freedom. It was about being your own boss. And they realized that. It takes a while to realize that You can go from town to town. You don't have to tell anybody. You can just say, hey, I think we'll run over to so-and-so. And that's freedom. Or you can go to the store. You can go to the park. You do whatever you want. You don't have to report. You don't have to see anybody. There's no armed guard or anything like that. That's what they had when it was over. They really appreciated it, really. The Europeans, whatever it was, even the German people realized when the war was over and there were Americans all around, they wanted to know all about America. This country, you don't realize it because you live here and you're spoiled rotten, but this is the promised land.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the sense I got was that even though you did all these things, even though you've held on to quite a few items and a lot of memorabilia from that time, you came home and you got on with your life. You did some performing. You were an electrician for Pasadena School District. Got a picture of you there up on a horse leading the mounted unit for Los Angeles County, so you're busy and busy. It sounds like your family hadn't heard all that much about what you did in the war.
No, one of the things is I didn't need to talk about it. They knew, okay, Dad was a World War II veteran, and that was it. I had the GI Bill so he could go to school, and had a VA so you could get a VA loan, buy a house. Those were advantages, and that was about it. I didn't talk about all that. It wasn't something that we, you know, I did save everything so that they could look it up later, but it wasn't essential. I didn't get any medals. Well, I got a good conduct medal, and I didn't probably deserve that either. But anyway, why? It's just like anything else. You go vote because that's the thing to do. You went into service and served because that was the thing to do. I don't care if you're from Korea or in the Vietnam. But you went because that was the thing to do. And God bless those people.
Amen. And on that note, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving. Thank you for answering that call. Thank you so much for sharing this story. And I asked you what your family knew because it sounds like your experience with Honor Flight Southern Nevada has opened a lot of doorways to conversations. They told me you rarely wear a hat that says World War II veteran, but you wore it one day. They spotted you. They said, you need to go on the honor flight. And then you did that. What was that experience like for you with Honor Flight Southern Nevada?
It was a wonderful experience, very emotional. And I would recommend it to any veteran, if he gets a chance to do that, to do it.
You said very emotional. Was there a particular element of it that stirred the most emotion for you?
Sure. I mean, you know, you see the unknown soldier, and you see the thousands of graves of the soldiers there, and the monuments, all the various things that, you know, you realize that it's hard to even express the thing. When you see all that and realize what it's for and why, it makes you want to cry.
Am I inferring in your comments, too, that there's an element, whether it's there at Arlington or at the World War II Memorial, where they've got those 4,000 gold stars representing 400,000 who died? Is there an element of, hey, that could have been me?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, the thing is, it's just like any time something happens and you survive it, you question yourself, well, okay, I made it. How come? You're lucky you got to this point. So, yeah, it's constantly a question. Well, I guess whatever omnipotent power you want to give allegiance to is watching over you. I've never been one to preach religion, but that's the way it goes, you know.
You feel like there was some protection or divine intervention on your behalf?
Well, there's no question. I mean, you this isn't an accident. I mean, you got to look at the whole thing.
I just mentioned that wall of gold stars at the World War II Memorial. When you were there looking at that, were there specific individuals that you had known that came to mind for you?
Yeah, always. You know, you think of some of the guys and some of the things that you've seen. And yeah, and you don't want to remember that, but they come back to you. That will cause you to really break up. I remember one, I was sitting there someplace looking at that wall, and I remembered a guy by the name of Yapjack. That's a Polish name. He lost it. He just was under fire, and he charged a machine gun nest, took the machine gun nest out, killed him. So you remember that? Yeah.
And I recognize that's not easy to talk about, and I don't take it lightly that you're willing to help us understand a little bit of what you've been through and what you've carried with you for all these years.
Never, ever forget, even if you want to. Kind of like an open wound in a way. You know, it's there. If you pick at it, you're going to bleed again.
Well, again, thank you for taking so much time to help us understand what it was like. This may not be an easy question, but when you think back over those years and all the years, 97 years on this planet, it's clear you're not done. People can hear how with it you are, and when they see you, they'll see how young you look, full head of hair and plenty of energy and all that. When you look back on 97 years, is there something that, in your mind, you're most proud of or satisfied with or thankful for?
Well, sure, you're an American. That's it.
And that is plenty, isn't it? Robbie Robinson, 97 years old, of Henderson, Nevada. Quite a tapestry he has woven for us over the last hour. Don't forget to check out those photos and the short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for the connection to Robbie. We are out of time today, but I hope you'll join us again next time on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.